ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show this week. Hope everyone is hanging in there with this quarantine or whatever you want to call it. I think it was last week I heard Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas describe how he feels like Tom Hanks in Castaway right now with being confined to home. I completely relate to that. I'm growing a beard. I feel like I'm always in the same clothes, working in my basement, which definitely feels like I'm on an island. You know, I come up at lunch to spear some food or whatever. It's odd times for all of us right now. In any event, I have three excellent guests for you this week. I'll first be joined by ETF.com's Drew Voros. This should be a lot of fun. We're going to go around the horn on several big ETF stories recently, including BNY Mellon launching the first zero-fee ETF with no strings attached. There are no catches here. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how the Fed is now able to purchase junk bond ETFs. And we'll touch on a couple other hot ETF topics as well. I'll then be joined by Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors, who they offer a suite of trend-following ETFs where they'll move in and out of different segments of the stock market based on very mechanical rules involving the 200-day moving average. And actually, they now have a bond version as well. I think that uses the 100-day moving average. But this is very timely given everything we've seen in the markets recently. So we'll discuss the pros and cons of a trend-following approach. And I also do want to get Sean's thoughts on the financial markets right now. And then to close this week, I'll be joined by Justin Castelli, co-founder of the AGC. I'm really looking forward to this. Justin is someone who is really trying to elevate the wealth management profession. So he runs his own registered investment advisory firm. He's a consultant in the space, but he also recently founded the AGC to help other financial advisors grow their practices and better serve their clients. So we'll talk about that. And then stick around because I am going to ask Justin about ETFs. And I have a few rapid-fire questions for him that you're not going to want to miss, trust me. So again, great show. Questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can go to etfprime.com. Let's start with ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance. Selling a private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, how are you hanging in there right now? Do you feel like you're on a stranded on a desert island like I do?
Not too bad. I mean, we have shelter in place here, but you know, you can walk your dog, and I actually get in my car and drive, not go anywhere, but just listen to music. So I almost forgot that. What it feels like to drive a car, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
but we're all good. We're all good and healthy. That's all that counts.
Well, yeah, I'm glad to hear that. So look, we're going to cover several different topics this week. And I thought we might start with this news last week that the Fed can now purchase junk bond ETFs. And of course, it was, just a few weeks ago, they announced they could purchase investment-grade corporate bond ETFs. Now they're potentially in the high-yield bond ETF market. What did you make of this? Were you surprised at all?
A little bit. I mean, the LQ, back in March 23, or March 23rd, you know, they announced they were going to buy investment-grade bonds, and they tied to that ETFs, such as LQD, and we saw a big jump in all bonds, really. Once the Fed comes into the bond market, that's a sign that, you know, there's a lot of front-running, going to go on. But also keep in mind the Fed can only buy 20% of any ETF. And these bonds that they're looking at are, you know, LQD has $41 billion, and now going into the junk bond market. And they're also buying junk bonds individually, not just ETFs. So we're seeing a little bit of a pop, obviously, in performance, but much more so on the investment grade bonds than so much the junk bonds, which is a recent development, obviously, from last week. But I think what's interesting here is that it is just a signal of liquidity to keep the bond market moving. And it's, again, not just focused on bond ETFs, but the entire bond market.
What do you make of the move overall? I know this is really generating a lot of controversy out there. I think there's a lot of questions around whether or not this is warranted. How do you assess risk return in this environment? You know, is this impeding price discovery? And you think about everything the Fed has done overall, right? They've taken rates down to near zero. There's basically unlimited quantitative easing now. And, you know, purchasing junk bonds, I certainly get the rationale behind why they may be purchasing individual junk bonds. But when you get into bond ETFs, I just wonder if that's a step too far. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I would compare it to, I mean, the Fed bought mortgage-backed securities back in the financial crisis. And those were very risky. People were walking away from homes. So I think what they're just trying to do is settle the market a little bit. And I think it's warranted, to be honest. And, you know, we're not down to zero yet. We're actually at stable 75 basis points, I believe, today on the 10-year treasury. So in that regard, I think it's warranted. I mean, if the Fed really wants to help everyone from Main Street to Wall Street, certainly debt is something to be examined. And, you know, they're hitting the spectrum. And we don't know what exactly the Fed owns right now. There was a lot of front running, obviously, right when the announcement came out. I don't believe that was Fed money coming in right quick. LQD has seen $9.5 billion in new flows since March 23rd. And HYG has seen about $200 million in new flows since their announcement last week. So we really don't know. Unlike mutual funds, you don't know where the flows are coming from. But I imagine at some point the Fed will report its holdings.
Well, it's interesting. I saw a tweet, I believe it was yesterday, from Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas, who I mentioned at the top. He said all told, the Fed could purchase something like $25 to $26 billion in bond ETFs if they basically maxed out what they're allowed to do right now, which isn't nothing. Now, I don't know that they'll get there, but, you know, they could always change the rules of the game too, right? They could increase what they're allowed to buy. As you mentioned, there's a 20% max on any particular ETF, but I do think the flows will be interesting to watch. And you mentioned performance. You know, LQD had that pop a few weeks ago, investors front-running the Fed. Last week with this announcement, we saw HYG, the iShares High Yield Corporate Bond ETF, that popped 7-8% on the news. J&K, the spider high yield bond version, basically did the same. It's just going to be fascinating to see what happens here if the Fed does actually start purchasing these things. Something else we should mention is they cannot purchase ETFs if they're at a material premium to net asset value.
Right. And the other thing too, just for the audience, you know, if the interest rates go up, price will go down. If interest rates go down, price goes up, essentially. So you have to understand what you're buying here. Are you buying a yield investment or are you buying a bet on price appreciation?
No doubt. Before we move on, how long until the Fed purchases stock ETFs?
Not out of the question. As you know, Japan Central Bank has been buying equity ETFs for a while.
We can't rule it out.
Buying stock now by bailing out the airlines and asking for warrants back, stock warrants back. So I mean, it's sort of the same thing in a more diced way, right? I mean, if they're going to bail out the airlines and want stock back, it's pretty much the same thing, just not in an ETF wrapper.
All right, let's move on to another big story from last week, which was BNY Mellon launching the first zero-fee stock ETF that doesn't have any fee waivers or other restrictions. Now, they launched three ETFs altogether. I believe there are five more in the hopper, one of which will be the first free bond ETF. But all of these ETFs are positioned at an extremely low cost. How do you like BNY Mellon's prospects here to be competitive?
Well, let me just introduce the fund. BNY Mellon U.S. Large Cap Core Equity ETF, BKLC, comes in at zero expense ratio. They also launched the BNY Mellon U.S. Mid Cap Core ETF, BKMC, and the BNY Mellon U.S. Small Core Cap ETF, BKSE, which both have 4 basis points, which is basically free. What's interesting to me is BNY Mellon has been a big backshop ETF player, custodian, things that people don't necessarily see. So for them to come out now and start issuing is really interesting to me. And obviously, zero, you can argue whether it's a loss leader or not, but they're clearly got a playbook here to come onto the ETF scene in the next fund is going to be similar to AGG, you know, a basic fixed income fund that also will be zero expense ratio. But they're not doing the flashy advertisements that Fidelity did. Fidelity is on TV, you know, using, you know, some good 80s music behind them. But I think what it says here is that, you know, they see the opportunity. I mean, this is a big playing field. And they have a lot of customers. What's interesting for this, to me at least, is each of those funds that were launched came in, I think they're right now at about $25 billion in AUM, and a lot of that came in right away. So I think it's a BYOA, bring your own assets kind of thing right now. But we've seen that work before. We've seen it with J.P. Morgan's beta builders where they're, you know, there's something going on that we don't quite know about. But it's pretty obvious that there's intention here and that they're, you know, they're in it for the game.
Well, you mentioned the bring your own assets. I mean, BNY has significant distribution via their Pershing platform. A lot of advisors out there, and I don't think there's any question they'll push through that distribution channel. Certainly using these ETFs in their model portfolios and managed accounts instead of competing ETFs. So there's clearly some room here. I don't know if you saw this, but back when these ETFs were filed, the chief executive of ETF and indexes for BNY Mellon Investment Management, they made the comment that with increasing concentration among a few firms in the ETF industry, and they were obviously referring to iShares, Vanguard, and State Street, they really thought they could make some noise here, just given their overall capabilities and reputation. I think they feel like they could draw in institutional investors, which obviously that could bring retail investor interest. Do you think that they could actually compete at that sort of level down the road?
I mean, you know, iShares is $1 trillion. We're talking about 100 million here. But what's interesting to me is there going to be a conflict of interest as a backshop service provider for ETF issuers. Now they're an ETF issuer. For them to get $1 trillion quickly, no way. But we'll see. You know, and they obviously have a suite that's coming out for fixed income. So there is a game plan here, and certainly one that I think will succeed.
Yeah, I think this is one of the more interesting launches of a suite that we've seen in quite a while. I think back, you know, maybe J.P. Morgan launching the Beta Builders lineup. This feels a little bit similar to that, but I'll be very interested to see if they can gain some traction. Okay, one other story you and I haven't had a chance to discuss yet is the launch of the first non-transparent ETFs. And I know you hate the term non-transparent, by the way, but I guess we can both be unhappy because I'm not a huge fan of the term ants that's being used. I just think it's going to be a struggle to settle in on a name for these things. But American Century did launch the first two non-transparent active ETFs. I do feel like this kind of got lost in the shuffle with everything going on in the markets. I'm just curious, have you been able to track these at all? Are they trading well? Are there assets? What's your take so far?
Sure. For everyone's knowledge, we can be the industry leader on this. It is not non-transparent. It is semi-transparent. They come out with their holdings every quarter. Non-transparent, to me, as an English major in college, means you just don't know. but you will know even though it's lagging. And they're semi-transparent, which is typically a month, so there's a lag there. And then, of course, there are active ETFs that report daily, such as MINT, M-I-N-T, which is a short-term holding bond fund. So just want to get that out.
No, there. I know you don't like that term. I've just kind of stuck with it. It feels like smart beta or something where that was just used early on. But you're right. We need to do a better job.
Investors. It's not helping investors. And that's one of the things, you know, I'm going to be putting up a blog soon on this. Some of the labels in the ETF industry are just terrible. You know, ESG, nobody knows what that means outside the industry. And so when you say non-transparent, people think, well, you just don't know what you own. And that's going to be a hard sell, right, if you don't know what you own for the retail investor. But we'll see.
Yeah, my only pushback to that is just that there is a distinction here between these products and traditional ETFs. And whether you can't see the holdings on a monthly basis or quarterly basis, the fact is you can't see them on a daily basis. And I do feel like there needs to be some, not in the Precidian active shares structure.
But you can see them. It's not that you will never know what you're holding is the whole point. And I think anybody that dives into active management understands that this is, you know, not an index. It's under somebody else's control.
Yeah. I just feel like there has to be some sort of nomenclature that distinguishes them between traditional ETFs where you can see every holding every single day. But in any event, I know it's a sticking point for you. It is for me as well. Yeah. I don't have a better solution. But let's talk about these American Century ETFs. I mean, are they trading pretty well so far
trading
in terms of bid-ask? What are assets like?
They're trading. They didn't come to the table with $25 million, but so the American Century Focused Dynamic Growth ETF, FDG, has around $7.5 million in assets since debuting about, 8 trading sessions ago. And then American Century Focused Large Cap Value ETF, FLV, has got about $6 million in it. Modest, for sure. And both these funds, for an active fund, I guess you could argue, is cheap. FDG comes in at 45 basis points, and FLV comes in at 42 basis points. And they are trading, and they're out there. And as you said, I mean, it's a rough time to launch a product right now. BNY, we were waiting for, and obviously we saw AC, American Century launch. But at the same token, this is the new normal, and you got to keep business as usual. And we're definitely keeping an eye on the American Century ETF. And I think, you know, it's a hard sell for advisors right now to do anything. I feel for advisors because they're probably dealing more with, you know, panicked investors than investors looking to take on a lot of risk. But I think that'll fade. And I think we're going to see potentially, maybe this week, another active share fund coming out. I won't say who. But I think the rollout is about to start.
Well, one thing I will say with the timing is they could have had much worse timing, because I think if you look at when these launched, what was it, April 2nd, I believe?
Yes.
Performance
yes.
has been pretty darn well. I mean, can you imagine if they had launched back in, late February or something, that this could have really been disastrous in terms of timing.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, we were expecting these back in December. And then
I remember that,
Inside ETF conference, and a lot of people typically will launch things before the conference so they have things to talk about. And it just kept getting delayed. And for December and January, it was more about logistics, just setting up how to do this. And it's a new thing because the APs and the market makers are dealing with these products differently than they do with other products. And then obviously in February, March, things went south in terms of the virus. But the fact that they're out now, they're a product, they're a tool, another new tool to the ETF kit, which is awesome.
Drew, putting the name of these ETFs aside, how important do you think transparency ultimately is to investors? And I don't know if you saw this last week. CNBC had a story with the head of ETFs at American Century, Ed Rosenberg, who actually will be on this podcast next week. But he said, and let me read this to you, quote, "I was checking with some of the main websites that publish the holdings of every ETF and asked them what percentage of people that visit the site actually look at the holdings. And it's way lower than I anticipated. They said it was only 15%. So if you eliminate the people that really look for holdings, this is just an ETF to everyone else. Do you think the daily transparency of ETFs is overrated?
Totally. Totally. I mean, how many people know what they hold in their 401k down to the stock? They don't. I mean, for years, I used to own the Fidelity Contra Fund and a 401k. I didn't go study it. But I think the decision is real clear, and this is where I go with the nomenclature about semi, non-transparent, et cetera. If you want an active fund, you know you're going to get somebody that's basically, you know, your stock picker. If you want an index fund and you just say, hey, I'm happy with the S&P 500 because as that goes, the country goes. So I think it comes down to that kind of simplicity, and that's what I'm really trying to urge. I want to help issuers that, you know, keep dicing and slicing and making up acronyms is not helping. But if people understand that, you know, do you want an active fund or do you want a rules-based index fund? That's pretty simple.
Well, Drew, always appreciate the time. Certainly look forward to chatting again next week. Take care, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to see the beard sometime.
I'll have to post a picture out on Twitter.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Be safe.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. My next guest is Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors, who currently offers 23 ETFs with over $5 billion invested, including their Trend Pilot series of ETFs. So these use trend following to determine whether or not to be invested in a particular market. Sean is on the line with me from just outside Philadelphia. Sean, great having you back on the show.
Great to be on with you, Nate. Hope you and your family are safe and sound.
Well, you as well. Sean, let's start by talking financial markets. As we sit here today, the S&P 500 is down about 13-14% year to date, down about 18% from the all-time high hit back on February 19th. There has been a pretty big bounce, of course, over the past 3 weeks or so. Now, last Thursday, we saw more unprecedented action from the Fed. What I thought I'd do is just open this up to you. What's been your take on everything we've seen over the past month and a half or so?
Well, it's pretty astonishing when you think about it and you think about how much money the Fed has made available to support the markets. You know, you can put me in the neither bull nor bear category at this point, put me in the skeptic category. I'm the kind of person that really needs to see some data and some real information in order to determine what equity values should be. And I think we don't have any clarity on that yet. We'll start to get some now as we go into this earnings season. But, you know, keep in mind that, you know, for the bulk of the economy here in the U.S., we were only shut down half of a month, March. So that would be the, you know, one small part of the first quarter. You know, really, the real news is pretty far down the horizon. It's another quarter away from us when we see what the effect of April and then however long into May we go. But that being said, when you create this environment where essentially the Fed says we're going to backstop everything, it's hard not to be optimistic about the markets. But, you know, I'm more of a fundamental guy, and I sort of think that, you know, we're not going to go back to normal right away. You know, I'm, you know, hearing stories and reading stories about restaurants when they reopen will have fewer tables. That's going to affect their revenue and their profits. I'm hearing stories about people not wanting to go back to sporting events until we have a vaccine. And I think there's going to be real damage done by this shutdown, and some businesses will not reopen. So I'm just in a wait-and-see mode. But the analogy I give is if you're driving down the highway at 70 miles an hour and up ahead is the densest fog you've ever seen in your life, you don't speed up to go into it. You slow down or you pull over and you wait till it clears until it's safe to go. And so I just don't think we know whether it's safe to go. We know the Fed's going to backstop things, but that really can't be the long-term solution for our economy and for the markets and for the companies that we want to invest our money in.
No, I think your fog analogy is a good one. I mean, the fact is there is just zero visibility into what corporate earnings might look like down the road. We don't know how this is all going to play out. We don't know when people are going to go back to work, and once people do get the green light to go back to work and we get businesses up and running, we don't know what that startup is going to look like. It's not like flipping a switch where everything just comes right back online. It's going to be a process. So I think that's a really good analogy. As it pertains to the Fed and backstopping everything, you know, I feel like there was a lot more backlash in the sense that investors are starting to wonder whether there's truly downside risk to the market or if the Fed is always just going to step in and do whatever it takes. And I know the Fed has played a prominent role, even going back to the financial crisis, right? And since then, that's been a big story, is the Fed, you know, helping push the bull market along up until this point. But I do feel like here more recently, the criticism seems to have grown louder. What is your view on everything the Fed is doing? Do you agree with it?
You know, it's a very difficult question, because if you answer it from an intellectual perspective or from a fundamental or from a market tactician's perspective, you know, based on, you know, us being able to ascertain what real value is and what real risk is, then you sort of get painted as, you know, maybe a heartless person who doesn't care about all the suffering. So it puts you in a position where, you know, you have to be careful. I think there's an extreme amount of moral hazard involved in what's going on here. And there's potentially a significant amount of future liability that's baked in. You know, I think back to the fourth quarter of 2018 when the Fed, you know, was raising interest rates because they felt like they had the room to do that, and they were starting to deleverage the balance sheet, and the market had what was called a taper tantrum. You know, you remember.
Absolutely.
You know, the Christmas disaster. And so if the Fed's balance sheet now is twice as big as it was, and maybe even bigger than that with some of the off-balance sheet stuff that they're stashing over at Treasury, what happens when they unwind that? Or do they just hold it forever? And then what are the implications of that? Does that create inflation, or does that challenge the value of our dollars? You know, it's a very, very complicated situation right now. I think what they're doing for individuals is great. You know, there are people who lost their jobs because of no fault of their own, because the governments, whether state or local or federal, decided to shut businesses down. The bailout is, I think, what everybody worries about. You know, I read an article yesterday that said that 50% of all the wealth in the stock market is owned by the top 1% of people in the United States. And yet, you know, we've had trillions and trillions and trillions of all of our dollars being put forth to support essentially that market. And there's a very few people that are going to really benefit. We're obviously one. We're an asset manager, right? So I'm not, you know, we're part of that crew of the people that own our ETFs are benefiting in certain cases because of that. But we're spending everybody's money to prop up a very small percentage of the overall population, and you know that's been, you know, the argument against this, and the argument from one side of the aisle about income inequality, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out.
No, I completely agree. And I think from an investment standpoint, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier on the show as it relates to high yield bond ETFs, I just think assessing risk and return in this environment, when you have the Fed willing to step in like they have, it does make things more difficult. I guess you could just take the mindset of just being optimistic and knowing that, you know, they will backstop things. But I do think the risk reward dynamics have changed. And I guess on that note, Sean, let's talk about investing and managing risk in this environment. As I mentioned
before
at the top,
go
ahead.
The high yield thing's an interesting thing, right? But that's not where the real risk in this market is in fixed income. The real risk in this market is in investment grade or in bank loan funds, where there has been a change to the underwriting standards of those, where, you know, you have collateral light or covenant light bank loans being. That's where the real pressure is going to be. You know, 40% of all corporate bonds in the United States are sitting on that BBB line. They're one downgrade away from being junk. And what happened to Ford here recently, they did get downgraded, and Ford's bonds are trading at like a 35% discount to pre-downgrade. And so there's a lot of money invested in corporate bond funds where the mandate is it's going to be investment grade. There's a lot of money in pension plans, a lot of money with insurance companies and other institutions that can't own that can't own junk. And it's not that the Fed's going to backstop high yield. It's what happens to the value of those securities when they move one line over on the rating scale and there's that forced selling. The Fed may ultimately buy them at lower prices, but there's real risk in the fixed income market. You know, mortgages are under pressure right now. 30% of all Americans aren't paying their mortgage. Rents are, you know, being just, you have entire, you know, industries or companies across the country just not paying rent. Well, there's impact to that. So You know, the high yield part of the market was something that was kind of fascinating, and it's only really a narrow band in that high yield market that they're currently saying mm-hmm. they're going to support, which is those that were triple B March 20th and previous that are now double B. So it's an interesting time in fixed income land as we all watch the stock market gyrate up and down 3%, 4%, 5%, and 10% a day. You know, bonds in everybody's portfolio become that what's supposed to be that buffer, that safety zone, the thing that will cushion the decline of the equity portfolio. And we may be in as much risk there as we start to see what happens as a result of what's going on in the economy.
Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk about the Pacer Trend Pilot Series. These are trend-following ETFs, which actually does include a bond version as well, ticker symbol PTBD. But I know Pacer's three most popular ETFs are all part of this lineup. That includes a U.S. large cap version, ticker PTLC, a NASDAQ 100 version, PTNQ, and then a U.S. mid-cap version, PTMC. You also have an international version, ticker PTIN, a European version, PTEU, and then again, that bond version that I mentioned. Now, as of yesterday, I went to the website. All of these were in T-bills or T-bonds with the exception of PTNQ, which was, I believe, still 50% invested. Maybe first describe how these ETFs are designed to work, and then we can get into the timing of the move to cash on these.
I mean, it's really a simple premise. We use a moving average to determine whether we're going to be exposed to the equity index or, in the case of high yield, the high yield bond index. And the whole idea is to just at some point, because of price movement, just simply move to the sidelines and say, we're not going to go down anymore. And, you know, not all of the asset categories sort of behave in lockstep. You know, NASDAQ is a great example, still 50-50. So it hasn't gone down enough to go to 100% T-bills. But, you know, what we're trying not to do is to ride the market, whatever index we're using or whatever asset category we're using, all the way to its inevitable low. And they're used primarily in, you know, people's equity portfolios as a part of an overall long equity strategy. So, you know, right now, if you own Trendpilot in your portfolio, whether it's large cap, mid cap, NASDAQ, Europe, international, or high yield, for example, you know that at least portion of your money is not going to go down if we do retrace and go back to the lows or we start to get really bad economic news. And that provides people with some comfort, if you will, in terms of managing the risk on the downside. And then the other part of the portfolio, if it's in equities or high yields, if those asset categories recover and go up, you're benefiting as well from that. But the basic premise is so simple, Nate. It's just simply using a moving average to say enough is enough on the downside. We're going to go sit in T-bills and wait and see what happens.
In terms of the recent moves to cash, if I look at PTLC, for example, this move to cash in like early to mid-March. And so by doing that, you avoided another 15% move to the downside. But of course, since that time, we've seen stocks shoot back up and PTLC has missed that move. And certainly anytime an investor uses a trend-following strategy, whipsaw is always part of the deal, right? You might get bounced in and out occasionally, but to your point, you have that protection against the really big declines. Can you maybe talk about that and what investor expectations should be with these products?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, right? So we went down more than we would have wanted to on large cap because we don't want to go down at all if at all possible. We know that's not possible. But we want to miss a substantial portion of the decline. And so at one point we were sitting down 19 and I think the S&P was down 30 something year to date. And so we're doing exactly what we're supposed to for that part of the portfolio. And fortunately for the remainder of the portfolio, because of the Fed's intervention and because of what's happened, that part of the portfolio has recovered nicely. But our job in a portfolio with the trend pilots is not to capture excess return on up moves. Our job is to simply go to the sidelines and prevent further damage from big declines. That's how people need to think about it.
Okay, so with that in mind, can you talk more about the investor behavior component here? Because I know there are some investors, when they miss that up move, they have that fear of missing out, right? There's some regret. And if that feeling is too strong, they might not be able to stick with a trend following strategy. So even though you look at something like PTLC, it's very mechanical and it's done everything that it said it was going to do, it still might take a certain type of investors to stick with that over the long term. How important is investor behavior with a trend following approach?
Well, it's a two-headed coin. So you talked about one side of the coin, which is, you know, people might think about missing out if the market, you know, rallies real strongly and we have a, you know, very sharp V-shaped recovery to equity prices. I spoke with a fairly large financial advisor the other day who's a user of our strategies, and he said, look, for the 20 to 25% of my equity portfolios that are in the trend pilot, I'd rather miss out on the upside because I know the other part of my portfolio is capturing it than be fully exposed to another big prolonged downturn if that's what happens. So that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that while the markets are, you know, in free fall, from a behavioral perspective, it's nice to have something like Trendpilot in your portfolio because you know that some portion of your portfolio is not going down dollar for dollar with the market, and that might help you stick to your long-term plan. And long-term is the key to everything with regard to investing, and it's certainly the key to the Trendpilots. It's not meant to be a trading vehicle. It's meant to be a kind of a foundational holding in a portfolio. And then in times of turmoil and trouble in these bear market cycles, it helps the investor feel a little bit more secure knowing that a portion of their equity portfolio is now sitting in T-bills, even though the rest of their portfolio might be going down because they're not participating fully on the downside. So there's two sides to that coin.
And by the way, I should have mentioned, you also offer a fund of funds using this strategy, right? The Pacer Trendpilot Fund of Funds ETF, ticker symbol TRND. Do you want to briefly explain that ETF?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the hidden gem. I mean, we know we've sequentially rolled these ETFs out over time, and then we ultimately built the fund of funds version, TRND. And what that allows somebody to do is to essentially with one ticker buy multiple trend pilots. And the interesting thing about that is, as I said earlier, they don't all work the same way all the time. And so on a blended basis, you know, if you're going to use Trendpilot, what we try to encourage financial advisors to do is to use multiple versions of Trendpilot across all equity classes as opposed to just picking one. And the fund-to-funds version sort of does that for them. And then there's a secondary benefit inside of the fund-to-funds in that, you know, it is rebalanced on a quarterly basis. And because of some of the tax efficiencies that go with ETFs, you can actually have a portion of your portfolio rebalanced without negative capital gains implications.
All right, Sean, before I let you go, I wanted to be sure to ask you about two ETFs, which I think have been really nice success stories for Pacer. They've also performed nicely as well. The Pacer Benchmark Data and Infrastructure Real Estate ETF, ticker SRVR, and the Pacer Benchmark Industrial Real Estate ETF, ticker symbol INDS. Both of these launched about 2 years ago. Do you want to tell us a little bit about these ETFs and why their performance has held up? Because if you look at other REIT ETFs, they've been bludgeoning pretty good.
Well, and they should have been probably because of what I said earlier about delinquencies on mortgage payments and people not paying rents, right? But when you think about these two ETFs, they're part of an essential part of the overall ecosystem in real estate. The SRVR owns data centers, fiber optic networks, and cell phone tower companies. And as we all are learning, you know, because we're frustrated because our Netflix account isn't working like it's supposed to while we're all locked in our house, we are woefully underprepared in terms of the amount of computing power we need for some of these transformational technologies to take place, whether it's streaming or e-commerce or the Internet of Things or artificial intelligence or autonomous vehicles, we need more data capacity. You know, most of, and I say most, I mean, it's really more than, it's almost going to be exclusively in the future, all computing instances are going to take place in the cloud, and the cloud is nothing more than a building full of servers, a data center. So we own some of the publicly traded names that are great at building those centers and maintaining those centers. We saw an interesting story with Zoom because of the uptick in people using these video conferencing services like Zoom or WebEx. They didn't have enough capacity, so they made a deal with Equinix, which was one of our holders. And then the data's got to get from one place to the other, and that's the fiber optic network and the cell phone tower piece of it. And if we're going to have 5G, we need a big build out there. So that's that story, which we think is a long-term trend based on technologies that will continue to grow. On the other side, the distribution center side of it, everybody thinks of these distribution centers as like simplistic, huge buildings with a bunch of garage doors attached to them, but they're really a complex ecosystem of distribution centers that are needed to go from an enormous distribution center to a smaller one and then an even smaller one to one closer to the end users that we can get the product that they want to order online there the next day, or as we have more groceries being utilized, there's specialty refrigeration distribution centers that need to be built out. And I think that's one of the trends that will be longer term as we come out of this. I think e-commerce was going to be a fast-growing part of what we are doing. I think it's going to accelerate post-COVID-19. And so we have an ETF that focuses only on the publicly traded names that focus on building out these distribution centers. They're very complex. You know, there could be 70 miles of conveyor belts in these distribution centers as you get closer to the client, because everybody orders something different, right? If you went online and bought something today, it would be different maybe than what I would. And that product needs to be sourced. And so before you ultimately get it at your front door, that product might wind up in three or four different distribution centers in this ecosystem. And so we really like that story as well, because there's a big demand for more and more distribution centers that need to be built. And there are publicly traded companies that are great at this, that already understand all of the intellectual capital that goes into building these complex, which they don't appear to be on the outside, but very complex buildings that are going to satisfy this almost insatiable impatience of the retail investor in terms of getting stuff online. So like Prologis is one of the big names. And Server is a great story, as you mentioned. It was up a little bit more than 40% last year in a great market, and it's actually positive year to date as of yesterday in a terrible market. So it's correlated sort of in up markets, but because it's critical infrastructure, it tends not to be dollar for dollar correlated in the down markets.
Sean, how do you typically see investors use these ETFs? Is it a complement to existing REIT exposure? Is this a satellite play? How do you typically see this used in a portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, so we're having success with financial advisors who are using it as either an augment or a replacement for part of, if not all, of their traditional real estate exposure in a client's portfolio. I mean, I'm not sure you want to own office in any big way going forward, or retail, for God's sakes. So most broad-based real estate ETFs own all of those things, and so they're simply saying, I'm just going to be more specific or targeted in terms of what kind of real estate I own. So that's one place. And the other place where we're seeing people adopt is as a part of their core equity portfolio, as a way to continue to participate in the tech revolution, but not do it and be 100% invested in the FANGs or the Qs, to have a little diversification with their tech exposure and owning it as a part of their core equity portfolio.
Well, Sean, I always appreciate you joining me on the show. Certainly appreciate your perspective. Stay safe out there, and I'm sure we'll be in touch soon. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nate. It's great talking to you.
That was Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors. I'm now joined by Justin Castelli, co-founder of the AGC, which focuses on helping financial advisors grow their practices and really better serve their clients. Justin is on the line with me from Fishers, Indiana. Justin, great reconnecting. Glad to have you on the podcast this week.
Nate, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here. And real quick before we get started, you and I had a shooting battle not too long ago. Have you been back in the gym at all?
I have not, but you are jumping ahead on me. You're going to have to wait. I have something very special for you at the end here. So look, Justin, you have a unique story. You're a certified financial planner. You founded a registered investment advisory firm, RLS Wealth Management. As I understand it, you host a podcast all about the Benjamins. I know your wife is an entrepreneur, so she founded and she operates a kids' clothing store. And then over the past year, you decided to start another endeavor, the AGC, to help other financial advisors be more successful. And oh, by the way, you also have three kids. Where in the world do you find the time?
I live a boring life. There's only a handful of things that I'm really spending my time on. It's family, and it's work, and it's been trying to stay healthy. And if it's not in that realm, then I'm probably not doing it. But I'm lucky that a lot of what I'm doing for these efforts, it doesn't seem like work. So I really enjoy the podcasting and the content, and I enjoy growing this community. So while I'm working, it doesn't really feel like work, which I think is an easy way to dedicate hours of my day to do these things because I'm actually enjoying it. It almost feels like a hobby.
And before we get into everything here, how is your family all holding up during this quarantine or whatever you want to call it? Everybody doing well?
Yeah, we're all doing well. We're balancing e-learning and trying to find time for work and balance the schedule. That's been the toughest thing. But right now I'm actually on e-learning duty, so the boys just finished up while my wife's at her store getting things done. So everybody's healthy. Your family's doing well?
Everybody's doing well. Interesting times for all of us, but no, we're doing well here. Okay, so first, take us through your experience in the financial advisory space, because I think that's a good segue to then talk about the AGC. And I also want to add, for individual investors listening to this, I think you'll find this interesting because Justin has seen a lot, I think both firsthand and certainly through interacting with other advisors. And I think he can provide a valuable window into both the good and bad happening in the space. So Justin, take us through sort of your recent journey and how you got to this point.
Sure. I would say my path is not too different from many financial advisors. And there's a number of stops along the way as you figure out who you are as an advisor and how you want to work with clients. So the real quick is, out of college, I went to an insurance-based planning firm, realized that I didn't really want to make life insurance the primary focus of what I did. I went to a bank for a year and just hated the constraints of being inside the bank next to my manager all day long. I spent 7 years at a 403B company, which this is really where I began to find out who I was as an advisor and where I didn't want to be and where I wanted to be. So I knew I didn't want to work in a corporate environment for long because I didn't like having goals, having products I was supposed to recommend. I really wanted to focus on planning and working with my clients. So I used that time at the 403B company to get my CFP designation, to build a list of clients that I worked with, and I viewed that as, these are my clients, and hopefully they viewed me as their financial advisor, to one day go out on my own. At the end of my 403B time, I was going to start my own company. I deviated from my path and went and worked with another independent firm in town. And after a couple of years, realized that I really needed to be out on my own to do things the way I wanted to do it. So a lot of advisors have a bunch of stops along the way. Each one of them helps us figure out who we are as an advisor, how we want to work with our clients. And ultimately, I knew I wanted to be in control of what I did, structure my relationships. I wanted to work with young professionals as well as your typical baby boomers. And the only way I knew to do that was to go start my company. And that experience of trying to find out where I was going to go, who I was going to be, I felt alone a lot of the time as an advisor because there weren't a lot of my peers in Indianapolis that shared the same vision that I shared. I saw these visions. I saw what other advisors were doing across the country, and I wanted to do that, but I didn't really have anybody locally to help me figure that out.
Okay, so obviously that then led you to found or co-found the AGC. Tell us more about the AGC in terms of the focus, what types of advisors are going to be a good fit. Walk us through the overall value proposition.
Yeah, so the AGC I co-founded with my friend Taylor Schulte, who's a phenomenal advisor out in San Diego. And actually, I have to give him credit. The community idea was his. I approached him about doing a newsletter. We both like focusing on marketing and branding and content. And together, I thought we'd have a great monthly newsletter for advisors. And as soon as Taylor threw out the idea of community, I was all in. At the time, I was really trying to grow my advisory business working with entrepreneurs, and I wanted to build a community for my entrepreneurial clients. And then when he said community, it kept me on the same wavelength. So the premise of the community is a place where advisors can come together and grow personally and professionally. And I think it's a real important thing to realize that we are just as interested in the community of becoming better people, better husbands, spouses, parents, friends, as we are as becoming good advisors. So we're finding a balance between what can we do as advisors and grow for the future, and what can we do to make sure that we have the family life and the personal life that we want to have as well. As far as who is the community for, the only requirement that would keep anybody out of the community is if you're a financial advisor or not. So when we go through our open enrollment period, the only thing you have to be is a financial advisor. I do think that there's a little bit of self-selection from the advisors that are going to come in, because I think the advisors that get the most out of our community believe in the power of collaboration, which I think we might touch on here in a little bit. But historically, advisors have viewed each other as competitors. I'm seeing more and more advisors viewing each other as people that we can collaborate and learn from and make our profession better. So advisors who are interested in collaborating, interested in sharing, learning from others, that's really the main requirement. We don't care if you're CFP. We don't care if you're fee only. We don't care if you're commission-based. as long as your focus is putting your clients first and growing and improving our profession, then the community is going to be a good fit for those advisors.
And what are some of the specific things that you're doing to help advisors grow both personally and professionally?
Yeah, so we have, first off, there's a private community. So if the advisor people, advisors out there listening, they might be familiar with the finance Twitter world, the FinTwit. If you think of all the good conversations and collaboration that happen on Twitter, and you remove the restrictions of characters, you get rid of the bad actors, we have a private community where ideas are being shared, conversations are being had. Think of it kind of like a Facebook page, but a lot more detailed and a lot more organization to it. So we have our private community that lives on Mighty Networks that people are in. But on a weekly basis, we have webinars. And actually, when I hop off of here with you, we're having our first virtual conference today. So today's April 14th. We have Carl Richards leading us off. We have Judd Mackrell from Carson Group. We have Camille Roberson. And then we have a happy hour with Tyrone Ross and Douglas Bonaparte. But every Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern, we have a webinar that is geared towards the community as a whole. So we've had guest speakers like Josh Brown. We've had David Perel. We've had Roy Sutherland. We've had a local person who specializes in health and wellness come in and talk. But these hour-and-a-half webinars each week are designed to bring some type of growth focus for the community. On top of that, we're doing random pop-up Zoom meetings as well. So we've done one in the past. There was a community member that was a younger advisor asking about kind of the succession planning story that a lot of us fall for. There was a lot of great comments, and we just opened up a Zoom and had a hour-and-a-half long conversation with a bunch of advisors, giving this young advisor some advice and some knowledge that we all have from experience. So it's very collaborative. A lot of it lives in Zoom. We record everything. We know that everybody's primary role is being a financial advisor, and not everybody can come every Tuesday. So there is a library of over 60 Zooms that we've done just since last October of all the conversations we've had. We also have a book club. So it's very much community-driven. So trying to find ways to bring value to the advisors above and beyond just these weekly webinars is a task that I love. It's a challenge, but I think it's a lot of fun. How can we make this an extremely valuable community where advisors are growing, but they're also finding that sense of belonging that maybe a lot of us are missing in our current situation?
Justin, in terms of advisor success, something that I have to ask you about is the content side of the equation. And I believe this is actually how I came across you, I think, on Twitter. And I mentioned your podcast earlier. I know you do a lot of videos, obviously out on social media. You share more personal stuff. I'll see you share pictures of your family, different events that you're doing personally. You write blogs. Why is all of that so important?
I'm a very passive person when it comes to approaching people to let them know what I do and ask them to become clients. And when I was at the 403B company, I discovered the blog, The Reform Broker. So Josh Brown writes The Reform Broker. He's a hero of mine in the profession. And as soon as I read that blog, I told myself, that's what I want to do. I want to communicate in some form, writing a blog, to where I can educate people who are interested. I can let people know that I'm an expert and then let them self-select whether or not they might want to work with me just through getting to know me through my writing. So with discovering that blog, which kind of turned me on to it. And once I started doing it, when I started my own firm, I got into video because as much as I want to write, or I wanted to write at the time, I struggled with writer's block. And it was easier for me to pop on the camera to get a pressing issue communicated and out to the public. So that's where I came to video. And then I just, it kind of the creativity in me came, and I liked doing it all. But for me, the content is so valuable because I mentioned it lets people see that you're an expert. You can educate and help people, but then the real value, I think, from developing your business is people get to develop a relationship with you by consuming your content. They get to know you. They get to kind of see how you talk if you're doing video, or hear how you talk if you're doing podcasts, and they start to form these relationships before they ever pick up the phone and call. And there's a great conversation between Josh Brown and Tyrone Ross on another podcast, and Josh Brown basically said, you can't force people to want a financial advisor. And the best thing you can do as an advisor is be on the top of their mind when that event happens, when COVID-19 comes through and people's plans are being blown up, or somebody retires, or they have a baby. That's when people start thinking about financial planning. And if you're creating content and they're reading your blog or they're following you, when that event happens, they'll think of you, and then that's when they'll reach out to you because they already have built this level of trust with you just by following and consuming your content. So for me, content is the only way that I see growing my practice, and I think it's one of the best ways for advisors. Now, I do think as a financial advisor, you have to buy into it because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work without any return early on, but then eventually it pays dividends. You just have to be ready to commit to doing the work for a period of time with no immediate results, and then one day you're going to wake up and it all makes sense.
Is there a particular type of media that you think is most valuable, or do you think the content all sort of collaborates with each other?
So I believe that video, I think, is the best because it can be redistributed to a bunch of different types of content. You can turn a video into a podcast just by stripping out the audio. You can then have that audio transcribed, and now you have a written blog post. And you can create small segments of videos to do like Instagram stories. I just think video gives you the most run out of one piece of content. And I also think that video is the best way for people who don't know you to get to know you. You know, you can see what I look like. You can see the way my mannerisms come out. And you just get to feel and connect with somebody over video better than anything else. That being said, and I think this is true of anybody who might create content for your business. So the non-advisor listeners out there, if you're a business owner, content can help you grow. I think if it's most important, even though I love video, you have to pick the form of content you're most comfortable with. If you're not comfortable getting in front of a video, it's going to come across that way. People aren't going to believe it. They're not going to be attracted to you because you don't look comfortable. You're better off writing. So I think that you pick the form that you're most comfortable with, and that's the one you go in on, even if it's not video, which is my favorite.
Justin, before we move on here, going back to the AGC, you started to touch on collaboration earlier. And I've got to tell you something that I think about a lot, and I've always subscribed to this admittedly cliche philosophy that a rising tide raises all boats. And I truly believe that in the wealth management space. I think we all can help each other. I think there are plenty of clients who are seeking help. Now, look, I think competition is good, right? It's healthy, but that doesn't mean we all can't help each other better serve clients, which should be the end goal, right?
Right.
So the question I have for you is, why do you find some advisors are so adverse to collaborating with each other?
Before I answer that, I just want to echo your beliefs, because I believe that as well. I've written about it before. And I just the other reason I think it's good for us to collaborate is, you know, let's be honest, the financial services profession does not have the best reputation. And we've earned it over years of doing things that aren't always best for clients. I view it as if other advisors are doing great work and we collaborate and I help them and they get better, that lifts our profession as a whole. So whether or not it directly impacts my business or it impacts the way the public views financial advisors, I think that is a great thing, because the more people that trust us, the better it's going to be for all of us. So we all get better together rather than independently. So I agree with you on that. The reason I think there's two main reasons for the lack of collaboration or the fear of collaborating. I think first of it, just culturally. For so long, our profession was sales driven, so it was zero sum. I made the sale or you made the sale, I got paid or you got paid, you're looking at two advisors. So the fact that it was always sales-driven and it wasn't relationship-driven, you could always find that next sale. You would never exhaust the number of clients that you could service if you were just selling. So that old culture, and now that we're moving more towards advice and clients are looking for relationships and they want advice more than they want product, you know, there's only so many households that an advisor or a firm can help. We can't help everybody. So there's less need to keep on finding that next client. It's more about finding the right client. And not every advisor is right for every client, and not every client is right for every advisor. So the more we know what each other's doing, whether that's collaborating on content or just collaborating and learning from each other, if a client comes to me that's not a good fit, I know another great advisor that I can connect them to. And while that doesn't help my business, that helps my friend, and that helps the overall profession. So I think that as we move further and further away from sales, I think some of that culture goes away. I've never worked in a huge corporate world, but I have friends that have come from the side of the business where even advisors within the same firm are competing with each other, and it's set up for that. That business model is going away. So I think as that business fades, we see more openness to collaborating. I do think the independent side of the world is more encouraging of collaboration because there's less goals and less incentives to kind of view advisors as competition. The other reason is, I think, technology. I think this younger class of advisor has grown up with Twitter. They've grown up with LinkedIn. And you just naturally find people that you're attracted to or that you have common interests with, even if they're financial advisors, and you begin to build friendships, and you realize that, hey, this person's not a bad advisor. They're not a bad person. They're not competing with me. And then that's where this collaboration. So I mentioned FinTwit earlier. You know, that network on Twitter is a bunch of finance professionals that are all friends, all helping each other, all sharing content, going to each other's platforms, all for the greater good of the profession and all for the greater good of helping more people. So I think that the younger advisors are just used to naturally connecting with other advisors through technology that advisors that have been doing this for 30 years didn't grow up with. So I think culture and tech are the two main reasons that there's a group of advisors that don't do it or are against it, and there's this newer wave of doing things within the profession that is a new culture and leverages technology to help out.
I think all of that is extremely well said. I'll just add, especially on the registered investment advisory side, advisors should be looking out for the best interests of their clients. And if that's the case, they should always be looking for better ways to do things or looking for the best way to do those things. And any one advisor is not going to have all of the answers. And so it makes sense to go collaborate with the best in the profession to help get those answers, which ultimately allows you to better serve your clients, which again is the end goal. Justin, just a few minutes left here. Obviously, this podcast is ETF Prime, so I have to ask you about ETFs. I'm just curious, are you a user of ETFs in your advisory practice?
I am. I use ETFs with younger clients. So with my younger clients, I have a scaled down subscription model of my wealth management relationship. And in that, I just use a risk tolerance program that puts in portfolios, and I use ETFs. And the reason I initially started with them was my model started before we had commission-free trading, so I could trade ETFs for free. So as my clients were saving on month-to-month, they weren't getting dinged with commissions to save into their Roth IRAs or their investment accounts. So I use ETFs for that business model. I use ETFs in taxable accounts, obviously, for the tax efficiencies of ETFs. And then I also have a tactical component to my retirees' portfolios that I run with ETFs as well. And I just use the basic total stock market, you know, total international, ex-US, small cap value. I'm not picking any specific sectors or doing anything crazy. I just want broad market exposure. And the ETF allows me to do that either efficiently through tax efficiency, or I can do it low cost, very easy to trade, to manage the portfolios for my retirees. So it's a pretty significant part of what I'm using with my clients.
All right, before I let you go, I mentioned I have something very special for you this week. I don't always do this. I'm going to close with some fun, rapid-fire questions, I think one of which you can already guess on. So I'm just going to spit these out. You can answer as you see fit. I promise these are harmless, at least I think. So let me start with this. I know you're a hip-hop fan, which I appreciate the genre, but as listeners of the show know, I am preferential to alternative music, especially 90s alternative, but I do appreciate hip-hop.
I heard the Weezer on the way in.
That's right. So here's a question for you. Give me the best hip-hop artist of all time.
I'm going to go with Tupac as my favorite.
Ha, that's so funny. That's actually what I would go with as well. I think especially his really early stuff, even going back to Digital Underground, you know, before he really went mainstream. That's too funny.
Most people don't know he was a part of Digital Underground. So that's impressive.
Hey, you never know what you're gonna find on ETF Prime. Okay, so next, as you were alluding to earlier, there was a Twitter thread where several of us were going back and forth to see who could make the most consecutive three-pointers. Now, I posted video of 9 straight, which, by the way, that was after a 5-mile run. I just want to point that out. However, you beat that with, I believe, 11 straight, if I recall correctly, and I think that still stands as a current best, right? Nobody's won up that yet. Although, as I mentioned, once this quarantine is over, I am getting back into the gym, just so you know, your 11 is not going to hold. But here's the question. Realistically, how many consecutive threes do you think you can hit?
In the way that we did it, I think maybe I could get to 15. So for listeners out there, we had to get our own rebounds. If I had somebody rebounding and passing me the ball, I could probably get into the 20s. But that going to get the ball and resetting up and kind of breaking your groove, I think I could get to 15.
I agree. Having somebody rebound makes a huge difference because you can kind of get into a groove and just keep firing them up. If you get hot, I think you can probably get into the 20s. But I'm going to beat 11, so I think I can get to 20 as well, even getting my own rebound. So once this is all over, we'll have to get back in the gym and keep that going. Maybe at some point we can do it in person. Okay, as I mentioned, you are out on social media. Unfortunately, there are a lot of trolls out there. I honestly don't get it. I feel like life's too short, but the fact is they are there. What is your favorite tactic for dealing with trolls?
You know, I used to hate blocking, but now I just block. And the main reason I block is I don't think it's fair for somebody to occupy my mind space and bother me, especially when most of the trolls, they don't ever offer anything up. I'm not the type of person to block somebody because I disagree, because I want to learn. I don't know everything. But when you don't bring anything to the table and all it is hate, I don't have time for that. I don't have energy for that. And I also don't want to promote it. And I feel like letting you come on my thread doing that is promoting and accepting it. So I think as much as I used to not want to block, blocking is the best way to handle that.
All right, last question, sticking with social media, and I am putting you on the spot. I know this one will probably make you a little uncomfortable. Give me your favorite follow on Twitter.
My favorite follow on Twitter. Man, that's tough. I have so many good friends. I'm going to have to go with Tyrone Ross. And the main reason for that is Tyrone has become a very special person in my life. We're basically, like, I consider him almost like a brother. But the reason I think he's such a great follow is he is so inspirational. And if you look at what he's been able to do over the last year as far as movements with the sock drives and the donations and what he's doing and the impact that he's having, you know, he's having a great impact, but he's also making you feel better and be better. So I'm going to go with Tyrone. I'm going to apologize to all my other friends out there that I didn't choose.
Well, I think that's a good suggestion, and I'll throw out his handle. I follow him as well. It's TR401. Justin, great stuff this week. Congratulations on everything you're doing. Certainly wish you all the success. Hope you and your family stay safe during these unprecedented times. But thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
That was Justin Castelli, co-founder of the AGC. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, if you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate a quick review wherever you listen to the show. We also always appreciate your direct feedback as well. You can submit that through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by Ed Rosenberg, head of ETFs at American Century Investments. We are going to go in-depth on the first actively managed non-transparent ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.